What's going on, guys, and welcome back to, I can't say this week's episode of Let's Just Talk podcast, because it's been probably close to 6 months since I've done an actual podcast, because I gave it up for a while, and when I get a chance to speak to some people I am very interested in speaking to, I will happily come back to record a podcast. So, Nigel, I think now I'm going to say a fourth time podcast guest. It might be three, but it's either three or four times, but I've missed our continuous Friday chats that we used to have, where we used to try and solve the world's dooming problems. And I appreciate you giving up your time to have a chat with me and indulge me. And should people enjoy our conversation of the world ending, or is it not, and we've got something to do about it, then I appreciate it either way. But Nigel, I appreciate your time and welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here. I clearly didn't do so badly last time that I managed didn't ruin your ratings so tough that I wasn't a useful guest. So I'm happy to be here in the studio in Melbourne. Maybe my next one will be in the studio from New Zealand, but it depends a lot on the volatile Australian property market, which we may or may not discuss in the next hour.
Well, it's something, obviously, I've moved into the property domain now, being a mortgage broker. I'm sure we'll talk about property in some way, shape or form. But yeah, I mean, just give us a bit of update of where you're at the moment. Cause yeah, I know obviously you're sitting in that house, but it's up for sale at the moment. Is it? Yeah,
it is. Trying to sell this place. It's a sort of it's a house and it's an art gallery. It's a music studio. And that hasn't appealed to the vast majority of people looking for a property in Middle Park just yet. So you know, that market's been interesting. I've obviously been associated with real estate since I joined the REA group, realestate.com.au, back in 2011, which is, you'll remember me getting that job and my excitement about it. It was in a crazy ride in that time. So clear interest in it. It's very volatile. It's very up and down. So one weekend, nothing sold here. The next weekend, five homes went. And it's, you know, demand, supply, it's a very strange, and it's kind of us finding the ways of describing those markets is kind of it's a symptom of what we're here to talk about today, is how the world is changing. And you just can't apply old models to the new world as easily, you know. That's, there's a great, I'll kick off. You know, I love my quotes. So Peter Drucker, who's a management consultant theorist from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and you know, since I am a management consultant these days, go straight to the source. He said, the greatest danger in times of turbulence is not the turbulence. It's acting with yesterday's logic. And yesterday's logic, you know, even the logic of 15 years ago often doesn't work today. So, you know, learn some new skills. That's the trick. Adapt, move around, do what you've done. Take on new challenges and just keep moving around. Because whilst it is the worst of times, it is not the worst of times.
Yeah, I mean, I love that last quote that you said there. It's like in the micro, and everyone has their own little micro ecosystem that they revolve in. And, you know, we all think we're the center of the world kind of thing. And that, you know, it all must be going to shit because I'm having this really shit time at the moment and the world's never been worse and it's never had more problems and things like that. But if you then kind of just go back 50, 60 years, maybe 100 years, maybe 500 years, like you kind of go, hang on. The issues are they're there. And I don't want to kind of downplay people's struggles that they go through. And we all go through struggles on varying levels. But I'm pretty sure for me, I'd love to be in this time and my struggles compared to the Black Plague, or, you know, medieval times. And like I think it's a pretty good place to be around at the moment.
Yeah, it's an important point to remember to put yourself in history. And wonderful new book published this year, Yanis Varoufakis, who is an economist, a Greek economist. He's the Minister of Finance there. He's published many really accessible economics books. And his new one's called Techno-Feudalism. And he's just going, he's reflecting on conversations with his father while he was alive and how unique the last 70 years have been. And for, you know, let's go back 4,000 years, so the pyramids, that kind of thing. For only 70 years in that long period of history, did we have what we enjoy today, these kind of liberal democracies where we vote for the people we want to run our place. There's an equalizing of rich and poor through taxation. Trust me, that's a unique experiment in human history, and it's failing in America. It's failing in other parts of the world. And truth is, the long term, we're probably destined to go back to basically kings and queens and dukes, and we're all the peasants and the serfs down below in the system, you know, digging in the mud. And that's actually the true pattern of human history, and what we've just had this bizarre time we've lived in, incredible scientific advances, all those sorts of things. And feudalism is in fact what we're good at. And just a matter of which side of that you end up on, are you a duke or are you a peasant? That's the problem.
When you say there's patterns, is there any kind of like long-term pattern to show? Was there ever a time, you go back, I mean, thousands of years, was there a time where kind of people did coexist in a kind of more democracy style, or is that a very recent kind of tradition since like America founded that and their kind of experiment on creating a country? Kind of, like, is that how early it is kind of thing, like a few hundred years ago, or does it go back further?
But not in large scale is the problem. So there's plenty of evidence of societies, you know, and we really do need to look to the sort of harmony that a lot of First Nations lived in, which I think is why there's this growing interest in how resilient and sustainable their lives were. We're here in Australia, Australian Aboriginal people, their philosophies, they seem so different to us, but lived in harmony with one of the toughest kind of environments to live within, you know, whether that's the deserts of Western Australia or the, you know, the dry grasslands of Victoria, thrived within that, kept a sustainable sized communities, and were very organized if we, you know, avoid the propaganda that they were hunter-gatherers and start maybe buying into some of the theories of Black Emu's controversial book about, you know, there were genuinely large settlements and technology and pottery just discovered in Brisbane, you know, 2,000-year-old Aboriginal pottery. Well, they were not supposed to have pots, but they did. And it's, I think there's this, if you look back in history, a lot of First Nations people, the Amazon, those kind of lived in harmony, but not without conflict, to be fair. You know, probably it was very difficult to scale your community because you ultimately, diseases spread faster, you know, even faster than jumping on planes to Melbourne and catching colds. And they were more serious and the consequences were quite terrible, you know, like a, you know, that now we have this luxurious period of time with medicines and hospitals and all those kind of things. But it's important to look at what are the kind of the big flows and then decide what you're going to invest in and what influence can you have? What's your kind of circle of influence and what's your circle of control and what's way outside either for you? That's the only way you'll stay sane is thinking about those circles.
When you kind of say stay sane, thinking about your own kind of circle, I don't know if, I mean, this can be me. Sometimes I try and keep myself like in my little bubble of, in WA, in the most isolated city in the world. It kind of brings me peace at night thinking the world can pretty much go to shit and WA is probably the last place that's going to be affected because we're so isolated. And so I kind of think I'm kind of safe in my little bubble here. But it's too easy to kind of turn on the news these days or open up TikTok, open up Instagram, and you know, you see the conflicts and the stuff going down in America, and I'm sure we'll get onto US politics at some point and what's going to happen in the near future there and then the long future. But you say, you know, what you can control, but I mean, people just feel completely out of control that what can I even do? Like the world's turned into shit. This is happening here. And we're just along for the ride. Are we just along for the ride, or is there something that little old me and little old Johnny and little old Susie can actually do to have some effect on the greater world around us kind of thing?
Well, I think there is, to be honest. And I think how it plays out for us is that unit of family. And, you know, you think about us as an individual, us as a family member or a member of a social group. We live on streets, you know, we live in neighborhoods. You don't live in Perth, you live in a neighborhood that if I looked at your very intrusive Google map of where you were last month, I guarantee it's quite a lot of common pathways, school, grocery, sports, etc. And so your map of Perth's quite unique in that regard. And it may be no bigger than a hunter-gatherer's map of their life back in Western Australia 40,000 years ago on the banks of the Perth or the Swan River, which wasn't called the Swan River back then. So they are long-standing patterns. And I think it does start with just looking after you, looking after your family, looking after your street, and then going, oh, well, what about that there's that homeless person down on the street corner, or is there a service, you know, is it something like Orange Sky Laundry? Is there a van down in South Melbourne? What's that about? Can I make a difference to that? And it's very easy to get despairing about our ability to make a difference, but it's genuinely happening. You know, people leaning in and caring just a tiny bit, and in large populations. I'm fascinated and interested in a patron of Orange Sky Laundry, which is a very simple concept. Two young fellas decided that they would make a washing machine and a dryer work in a van and go around communities, not necessarily people sleeping rough, but all sorts of people who were lost from society. And like their real insight was just how quickly you fall off the wagon if something, two things go wrong. You'll lose your job. This day and age, nobody's got any savings. And a falling out with your family, you're very quickly sleeping in your car. And you may well have a job. You know, this is this emergent class. We're not peasants, but it's kind of like moderately independent, have a job, but no assets, no savings, no parachute, nothing. And I mean, in history, charities have taken care of those people, whether it was the churches or, you know, friendly societies, you know, the Odd Fellows, those institutions emerge, and we can all lean into those. They're not secret societies. And that's how I think we'll make progress. We can probably no longer rely on the concept of a liberal, democratic, left-leaning government where we all pay taxes and the money gets redistributed. That's probably the biggest change to come. And that agenda's long run. That began in America in the 70s and 80s. And that was really the pushback on the beginning of the end of this liberal democratic West that we now hold so dearly, but tend to vote the other way and let it collapse. Because they convinced us that capitalism was all about the 1% getting rich. If the rich are getting richer, then with society, as we call it, is better off. And that's a scam. That's a bit of a con job. And it's enabled them to talk.
Sorry, the trickle-down kind of effect? If they're getting old, then is that the kind of idea that they sold that on?
Friedman, trickle-down economics, Jack Welch at GE, Ronald Reagan, a whole series of, Margaret Thatcher, that they just changed the narrative. And that's now pretty much everywhere in the world where, there's a fundamental dividing line in belief between bad things only happen to bad people and bad things can happen to good people. And if it's kind of like whether it's reinforced through faith or reinforced through just the narrative of your society. Yeah, well, they're poor because they're stupid. They're poor because they didn't work hard at school. You know, he got made redundant because he was the lowest, you know, performer on the team. And we tell ourselves these stories and often not true, but we need to get, if we want to change where we're heading, we need to get back to it's okay to tax rich people, because that's the ultimate mechanism for redistributing income and believing that a society where nobody's starving while somebody earns 10, 20 million bucks a year as a, you know, an equities trader or some, or a CEO of a bank, those kind of jobs, then we need to just think hard about maybe taxes isn't a bad thing. And Australia is very lucky. We have a thing called the pub test, where, like, literally, would this idea fly at the pub? You know, in an airline CEO who earned $150 million over 13 years, and, you know, the end result was huge amount of taxpayer money went into propping it up and huge amount of jobs were lost and the customers all hate them. You can guess which airline this might be. That's not a good thing. That doesn't pass the pub test. Like, you know what? That's too much money. And our big bank CEOs who, you know, they take a lot of risk and they've got a lot of skill and experience, but really a $10 million bonus? Is that past the pub test when I don't think there's been too many pay rises for people at the basic level, nurses, frontline people, for the last 4 or 5 years? And it's those disconnects that people have got access to the data for now, that they were hidden prior. And that, in the same way, you're seeing far too much on TikTok about war in the Middle East, the Ukraine conflicts, all those kind of things. You're also able to see the other side, which is like, hold on a minute. economic growth has, you know, our ability to produce more stuff and all be better off has been growing like this since, you know, the 70s and this post-war, wonderful post-World War II life that I've lived as a baby boomer born in 1963. But wages for the average person flattened off about 1980, not connected to productivity from that point. And so, you know, in the US, really the hourly wage is not a lot different to 1980. It hasn't moved.
I remember seeing...
The cost of living has.
I remember seeing... I cannot remember the guy who was doing it. He was doing it as a talk. And he was like, the kind of idea of productivity and a business becoming more efficient and being able to produce more and then produce more income... And he said it can take two streams, and I'd love to kind of get your, I'm sure you've seen this clip or the idea is that the business has 10 employees and it pays, excuse me, and it pays them each $100 a day. And so their overheads are $1,000, but they're able to produce enough widgets, in quote, that produces $1,200. So the business goes, cool, we've got $200 of profit. As the business owner, get to take that $200 profit, and everyone's happy. Everyone earns $100. Then one day, some guy comes along and says, hey, I think I can make your business a bit more efficient, and we can get those widgets produced in either half the time, meaning you'll produce the exact same stuff, you can keep the exact same amount of people on, but you can just send them home at lunchtime. You still earn $200. They still get the $100. Everyone's happy because they get now less work. But then the business owner comes back, but why didn't I just cut half the staff? Half the staff still have to work a full day, but I save half the wages and I then take home double the amount of profit. And the widget kind of efficiency guy goes, that's a great idea. And so I bring that up to say that obviously businesses and AI and all these things kind of coming are just becoming more and more efficient via getting rid of more and more staff and making the people that do remain just work more, and then the businesses earn more. Like, how do we get back to the idea of a business going, you know what, I want to take care of my staff and maybe I give them half the day and I still, whereas it seems to just go the other way. It's like businesses are always trying to optimize and earn more profit. How do we kind of incentivize away from that when at the end of the day, shareholders are also part of that equation? Like, shareholders are going, hey, I want my returns on my investment as a shareholder. How do you keep everyone in that equation happy?
Yeah, it is. It's who's got the power to say what the rules are, because there are plenty of organizations globally now running 4-day weeks, for example, paying 5 days wages, working 4 days because of the productivity increases they've got. Not everyone chases hyper growth in that sense. But I've got some terrible news as your economist advisor about productivity and particularly technology. You take the last 30 years, the OECD did this incredible report going, okay, gross domestic product, as this adding up of all the things we make in Australia, New Zealand, America, wherever, that's grown substantively, even in the last decade. Fabulous. It must be all of the new ways of working and technologies and computers and the internet. That's clearly done it, because, you know, 30% growth in GDP for Australia over that time is pretty bloody good. That allows you to pay for more social services, which we'll get to because we need them. And then they did the maths. They took the gross domestic product and divided it by the number of hours worked by Australians. Ah, okay. Now we have a problem, because that number hasn't changed since 2013. Barely gone up, like a tiny fraction of a percentage point a year in that time. Well, hold on a minute. We've had mobile phones. We've had the internet. We've had websites. We've had e-commerce. We've had Zoom. We've had Slack. We've had, what do you mean the amount of stuff we produce per hour hasn't actually gone up? Because the entire secret of what the West's productivity gain is, they've got you and I working more hours, and in Australia we brought more workers in. And it's a stunning number and a bit of a shocker, because when you start to think what now goes forward, as we've got the baby boomers exiting from the workforce, we're about to go backwards on the number of people in the workforce. For the first time in a very long time.
How many hours?
5 million people at retirement age here in Australia. And we desperately need things like AI and thinking about, you know, Japanese thinking around lean and factory efficiency and technology and tools. We desperately need that to generate more wealth without actually working more hours.
And so what is the average hours that the average Australian is now working compared to, as you said, 30 years ago kind of thing when that...
Well, it's well in the 40s now. And like in America, there are states where the median employee has two jobs.
Yeah, right.
Because their real wages have not grown at all in that time. I mean, here's the classic thing. It's becoming cheaper for American companies to manufacture in America, which because future President Trump loves that idea because it's jobs and actually it's keeping the, you know, the proletariat, keeping the peasants quiet because they're too busy trying to feed their families. It's very useful. They don't get out and protest as a result. Given the growth in the middle class in China and wages there, if you add their wages, their technology investments, plus the cost of freight to the US, it might be cheaper to make plastic junk in California than Guangzhou. And these are the unexpected consequences of sort of the post-war experiment that the world's been a part of with its geographies, its kind of its technologies, its investments in science. And I think different societies are at different stages of that. I think America is a brilliant essay by a guy called Sir John Glubb in the 70s called The Fate of Empires. And he talks about the phases empires go through, you know, from invasion and exploration and agriculture and then science. And then this last, you know, over 250 years and the last block of about 40 years, it's called Bread and Circuses. In acknowledgement of the end of Roman society, a couple of different goes at it in Rome. And yeah, put all the poor people in the stadium and give them some bread and give them some circuses to entertain them. And in the meantime, it's just the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting the picture, to quote the wonderful Midnight Oil surfer line. And you know, what are the things that track us into that last kind of phase are fascinating. It's how much every single, you know, Assyrian empires, Egyptian, Roman, Greek, all the way through to modern civilizations, the kind of the how what you track to say is the end coming is pretty similar, and it involves simple things like how much are sports people paid. And it really quite surprising that the highest paid sports person in all history was a charioteer back in Roman history. Like, he earned more money than, you know, name all the big basketball and football contracts of the last few years. I mean, I think he had a lifetime earnings of $15 billion.
Jesus.
So there's a correlation between you pay your sports stars too much and the end of society. Well, we're pretty close to that. There's a job in society that when you reach a point of that's the job you love and respect, and it's like, oh my goodness, yeah, I must have that person in my life. They're the rock stars of your society. Your society's about to end. Have a guess what job that might be.
I was going to say something in entertainment, but
yeah, you're close. It's a chef. So when, you know, Greece and Rome, all the rich people could afford a celebrity chef to come and cook for them. It marked the end of those 200 year cycles. And I see a lot of that kind of weird rich poor social equity gap emerging in places. And we just have to not go there. We have to not believe that bad things only happen to bad people. But, you know, I track four megatrends that everyone should be interested in and should lean into. They're the climate crisis, the declining social equity, they are technology. Oh, there you go. I get the bubbles effect from my fabulous technology here. That, you know, disruptive technology like artificial intelligence, that kind of stuff. But the most powerful of these four megatrends is an aging population, because you can do nothing about it. And because we're just like, here I am, I'm 60 now, and I can't stop that. I mean, I'll live longer. That's okay. That's fine. But that this is phenomenal because it plays into all of those other ones in terms of who's got all the houses. You know, a third of American three-bedroom homes are owned by people aged 60 to 78. And add a ton more on top of that from 78 to 90, the silent generation, they call them, not boomers.
Yeah.
And they're not giving them up, Adam. So good luck if you're in the mortgage business, for example, because that's their forever home. We've used that term for 10 years. Well, holy shit, that term just came home to roost. So when I worked at REA Group, the kind of average hold time for a property in Australia was about 8 years, 8 to 9 years. And we noticed it increasing and we thought, oh, this would be to do with slightly tougher markets and times, and maybe it's, you know, people coming in from offshore who invest in property for the long, long term, particularly central urban type places. And then the demographers and the population experts sort of said, how's that number going? And they had a look. So the average hold time for an Australian property is closer to 15 years now and growing 1 year for every year. Why is that? Because so much of the property is owned by boomers who ain't moving. And in the US, they're not moving because the other phenomena there, the fixed rate mortgages, you probably do a few of those. You know about those. You're an expert on those now. What's the term for a fixed rate mortgage in Australia?
Well, we usually anywhere from kind of 2 to 5 years for right. us here, so but they get them for America, 30 years, don't they?
20 to 30 years for a fixed rate mortgage. So if they, you know, they locked in a fixed rate mortgage on their home 5 years ago, it was 2%. There's no way they're moving and have to renegotiate the mortgage and have to pay 7.
And probably a property that's worth a hell of a lot more as well that they're trying to get into.
Well, and of course, if they shift downwards, they pay capital gains in the United States. And so these dynamics, these are the human, societal, economic dynamics that make, like, it's a much more complex world when we look at it with our glasses on and kind of see how it works. And it's in the past, we've oversimplified it. But those four mega trends, incredible. You know, the cost of climate change, I mean, whether that's just in, you know, I saw an article on homes in New South Wales and the levels of insulation required for keeping the standard operating temperature down to human habitation levels. And all those standards are based on climatic data that's historical. Well, it's going to get warmer unless you're kind of one of the happy friends who don't believe that climate change is a thing. It's going to get warmer. You're going to need more air conditioning. Energy's getting more expensive. Unless you're generating your own, and these homes are not well insulated enough. And so climate affects everybody in that regard. Where I've got, you know, our new family home in New Zealand was massively hit a year ago by Cyclone Gabrielle. So as a consequence of climate, my cost of living's just for waking up in the morning is more than doubled rates. And I'm lucky to get insurance on that property because plenty of people cannot get insurance on a residential property. Now, what happens, pop quiz, when you can't get house and contents insurance? What else can't you have, Adam?
A mortgage.
A mortgage, no chance. So what the hell happens to all of these properties over time? And it's kind of like, this is Australia's rocky journey to 2050, where an incredible, you know, we used to have a thing, a population pyramid shape, lots of kids at the bottom. You grew up on a street full of kids and not so many old people. Like 74 was like the life expectancy of somebody in the 80s. Well, it's now like getting close to 90 and nobody had any kids. You did well. You kind of replaced yourselves. We didn't, got the one. And so we didn't make little taxpayers to support this giant crop of boomers. It's called the baby boom because they had a lot of them. And they're all retiring and living in longer and totally expecting healthcare, roads, all the social services and support. And climate's messing with that. And these factors, they weave into each other in such complex ways. I met a woman who describes this brilliantly. She says, life in the 1990s and early 2000s was like you existed in the zoo. It was a, you know, life's a bit of a zoo. Go to the zoo for a visit. You want to see the animals, get photos of them. Everything's kind of in its cage. There's order to it. You can see the pathways, the signs, the schedules for feeding. There's a gift shop. You're safe. And like the animals are not crossing between cages. Everyone's staying in their cage, you know, stay in your lane, Adam. But she's going, that's over. It isn't like that anymore. Now you're in the jungle. So there's no signposts, no concrete paths, no schedules. Go on safari. You don't, your ticket doesn't say you're guaranteed to see the feeding of the lions at 2 p.m. because they're hiding in the jungle. So navigating in the jungles in life, in business, is very, very different. And you need different skills. You need real resilience. And the people facing into these social equity challenges of what we're basically going to have is the largest population of unemployed people in the history of Australia. They're just called retirees. They're not contributing greatly. Now, sadly for you, mate, like your generation's probably not going to be able to retire at 65. You might have to find, and you're very lucky to have trades that you can do and you have your health. So 70 is not impossible. You put a part-time work and build yourself a portfolio, those kind of things. But a lot of people don't. So social equity, you know, none of these things affect people evenly. Poor people will be impacted by climate far more dramatically than me. Even though I've had my rates go up and my insurance go up, man, poor people are just going to stop paying insurance. And that's what's happened. So they just go, we had the choice between insuring the house or paying the grocery bill. And particularly the aging thing, you know, it's, we're seeing it in China where by 2030, there'll be more retirees than workers. Japan, then in that 2030s, be two-thirds retired, one-third workers. That's not a ratio that works. And we're dealing with this mythology of my generation that all those taxes we paid all went into a bank account with our name on it to withdraw the benefits of in our old age for healthcare, Medicare, all those kind of things. I've just got terrible news for you. That's not how the economy works. If it's taxed that year, it's spent that year. And all your tax money went into building yesterday's infrastructure and not the future. And that kind of fourth factor of technology is where we've developed this long-term weird belief that technology will solve it, that medicine, that something will come along that solves the next pandemic. We're sure of it. It's blessed our faith in that. Just not necessarily true. That technology will solve poverty somehow, that technology will solve climate.
Is that idea backed by the fact that forever up until this moment, it has kind of happened that way? Like most people go, well, we're still here and we've faced all these issues and something has come along to kind of save us, whether that's our own humanity or a medicine or a technology. Like, is that where that, I guess, blind faith comes from that, well,
it is.
It'll happen again, we'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a bias. That it's a recency bias, basically. If you take that long history we started talking about back to the Egyptians, there's plenty of examples where nothing came along and it was pretty fatal as a result, the consequences. But recency bias is, my goodness, we were so lucky to get all those amazing vaccines for the COVID period. But there's a wonderful quote from a book, which is almost 100 years old, The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway. And it's after World War One, which paralleled his life. He's a famous American author and grumpy bastard, basically, but amazing writer and really interesting style of writing. And he's cataloguing the case of friends living in Europe after the horror of World War One, and they're kind of trying to find their way in the world and what's the meaning of it all, and these are terrible times and all these kind of stuff. And one of them's bankrupt. You know, the business hasn't gone well for them, but they're all drinking in Spain and trying to get their shit together, essentially. And one of them gets brave enough to ask Mike how he went bankrupt, because he's a bit of a cantankerous fella. And his answer is brilliant. And his answer is, gradually at first, then suddenly. And that's what all of those mega trends are going to do to us: climate, social equity, technology, and aging. It's gradual at first, and then Cyclone Gabrielle. And it's just a fascinating time. Western Australia fascinates me because there's so much intergenerational wealth transfer to happen in Western Australia in the 2030s and 40s. The value of real estate is unbelievable. Those gigantic farms. And, you know, and you're a boom market for real estate now. Everyone's caught up with the fact you've got cheap houses over there and wants to come and live there. But the Reserve Bank's done an estimate of how much money is going to be transferring from me, boomer, to you, Gen X, in the 2030s, from about 2035 onwards. Because we all, you know, none of us get out of here alive, as you've pointed out to me in the past. It's in the range of about $230 billion a year in property wealth transfer. Jeez. And you just go, oh, that's a lot. And what's going to happen to those houses? What's going to happen to that money? Who's going to buy them? Because they'll have sat in them for a long time. And what state are they in? Because they won't have had a lot of renovations in that time. I'm just going, I can't even imagine the state of Australia's property assets by 2040. Their houses built in the 90s, they'd be falling over, mate. They're not going to be worth anything. And is anyone coming into Australia to want to buy them anyway? Maybe. I mean, maybe the kind of whatever social revolution is going to occur under President Trump in 2025, maybe that drives Americans to Perth.
What's the, from what I gather, there's no tax that is paid on principal places of residence from handing down from a generation. Is that correct though? Like if my parents pass away and they've got a house, they can pass it to me and it's that property is tax-free at the moment. Is that correct? Or
no, that's all changing. And that's a really... These are the sort of things a generation needs to lean into now, because there's a lot of people, oh, well, mum and dad want to get out of that capital gain sort of situation, because they hand it to the kids. And I saw there's a great big financial advice column I read recently of what happens if it's right now, it's clearly secondary homes. So holiday homes, those kind of things, they're all taxable. It was this cunning plan somebody had. Okay, well, I'm going to buy out my two sisters now, buy it off mum and dad at this price, and then I'll avoid capital gains. It turns out, no, the ATO's got a knows this shit's happening all the time, tax avoidance. And so, yeah, you pay capital gains from when the time mum and dad paid for it a long time ago. The capital gains tax on primary residence is the end result of a mushroom-shaped, an inverted population pyramid. So there's no more income tax. You know, Amelia's not going to be able to support all the parents and grandparents and things that are requiring services at increasing levels, because we're going to live in our 80s and 90s. Her tax base, and remember, she's going to start out on $20 an hour, $25 an hour, and we've repressed all of those lower end wages as much as you can earn them. A million working in a public company in Australia. And that's only one asset left to tax, and that is property. So death duties, inheritance taxes, it'll be another form of stamp duty. I mean, whoever puts it up will be voted out at the next election, only to be followed by a new government going, well, we can't afford to lose it. And this will be the 2030s, and everyone will try to hide them in all sorts of trusts and all sorts of mad vehicles, but it's going to become very difficult to avoid that generational wealth transfer, the eyes of the ATO on that going, like a piece of that, please.
Gone are the days, whether you love them or hate them, the Howards and the Hawks of politicians' ages, where, you know, they reigned as, you know, supreme leader for 15, 16, 17 years. It just seems like this day and age, like politics is, how can I possibly be reelected for next, in 3 years' time? And, you know, governments seem to just change left, right, left, you know, every single time. Because as you said, one party says, here's our ideas. And the others just go, that's terrible. I want to hold my money, or I don't want to get, yeah. And then the other people come in and in essence, they do the exact same thing. And as you said, like, well, we were on our campaign saying that they were all thieves for saying that. But actually, guys, now that we're in power, because you voted this in because you didn't like that idea, we're going to do it anyway. Because, and so,
yeah, there's a lot of that complaint
moving forward.
I mean, whatever, that's the trouble with democracy. It's the worst political system ever invented, apart from all of the other ones. And every time you vote, a politician gets in, and that's the nature of the system we create. I mean, what kind of a system has resulted in basically two old white blokes in America duking it out? And they're both kind of dubious in terms of their resilience or their intellect, the state of their intellect on certain days. And, you know, Trump and Biden, it's like, I don't know. How did a system throw only those two humans up? And we're much the same here in that, you know, we've got a liberal national leader who's probably unelectable, which is just pumping the air into the tires of our Labor government, going, you know, we don't have to do much here. And so they haven't tackled climate, housing, social equity, health, all the things we thought would be natural with a Labor government. There's no reason to tackle them as long as, you know, Spud's the leader of the other side and so many people find it difficult to vote for as a result. But that is very disappointing in some extent, the lack of progress for such a lucky country like Australia. And yet it's fine, we can find $180 billion to buy submarines. I mean, do you know how many times that would solve homelessness, child care, health in, I mean, Aboriginal community health, all those kind of things? And I don't think those issues are going to get walked up to in the next 20 years in my lifetime. And that makes me sad. So I'll do my little bit, you know, within my sphere of control, family, and then things like Orange Sky. And, you know, I won't leave the planet in a better place, but I'll have done my little bit.
Well, obviously I'm in the mining world, hence why we're over in the West, because of my wife being in it. And so while people sit there and continue to say phones aren't listening to us, I guarantee they are, because the conversations I have with my wife then bring up certain things on my algorithm inside TikTok and whatnot. And the one that just floored me was just how little our government taxes our mining and fossil fuel industry. And they always make the comparison to, this is one that seems to be coming up on mine so much at the moment, is Qatar and Norway had these massive gas reserves and they tax their those companies that drill it out of the ground in those countries, billions and billions and billions of dollars. And then you compare it to Australia, we have the largest gas reserves bar none in the entire world, and yet our taxable on those is like $2 billion. And in Qatar and Norway, it was like $150 billion or something. And then someone did the comparison, like, if you guys just taxed exactly the same as we did, housing issues, society issues, healthcare issues, like all of them disappear overnight, because you all of a sudden have hundreds of billions of dollars back into it. And then obviously the flip is that, oh, but they'll all leave. And then they go, yeah, that was the threat that they did to us, and yet we taxed them. They're still here because they're still making billions of dollars kind of thing. So
yeah, it's a sad country where the ATO takes more money from HEX debt.
I saw that stat, yeah.
Than it does from the mining industry and extraction of petroleum products. Yeah, look, that those are the social equity issues that we've got to be cognizant of slowly happening over time. And it being okay, you know, like you see your senior politicians getting advisory and board roles with these giant international corporations. It's no coincidence afterwards, you know, the ScoMo maneuver. But it's been happening for decades and decades. And yeah, it's just, and it's banking. Look, I'll be honest with you. There's a lot of economists point to banking as being fuel for the kind of inequity in society. Property prices in Australia have gone up absolutely phenomenally. And there's a number of economists who go, you know what, houses are non-productive assets. If they'd loaned half that money to people with small businesses or, you know, education or stuff that like building projects, even, you know, they're productive assets. And in many countries in the world, there is a control on bank lending based on the fact, you know, you lend more money to fuel consumption, particularly consumption of property. Well, it doesn't really change the actual gross production of a country, but boy, oh boy, does it inflate the market over 20 years. And well, we're all part of that. I mean, I've got a mortgage and I built a new house, and you know, you're fueling the fire as well. But those are the things that I think we will take more care of in the future. And yeah,
it's sorry, tough. The idea kind of comes back, and like this probably comes to every homeowner on the planet. It's like, I hear your idea and I absolutely agree with it, but I have my mortgage. I don't want my house price to go backwards and be worth half what my mortgage is. And then the bank come calling saying, oi, you need to fork up the difference. Like, how do we keep that equation okay, where all of a sudden people's mortgages aren't worth far more than their property, but you still have that progression? Like, how do you solve that issue?
Yeah, no, it'll be a terribly politically unpopular maneuver to kind of dial back regulation on mortgage lending, for example, to go, you know what, you can't own 5 houses. And when that's cult, that's Australia's cult of the property owner is providing you independence from the government, because you probably can't assume you're going to get a pension of any kind at this point in human history, because there just won't be enough money. So you do need to look after yourself in your old age. So people get driven down the, I'm going to buy 5 properties and become a slumlord. And, you know, that's a massive political issue in Australia today, is their costs have gone up dramatically because of this external impact and inflation and interest rates. And so the poor people who are renting are, you know, they've faced some pretty substantive cost increases to rent, 30% rent increases. Well, gee, a lot more people in Australia rent than you imagine is the interesting thing. And the entire brilliant plan for running Australia across 20 years assumed that most of the people who got to retirement age owned their own homes.
Mm-hmm.
That was the massive assumption. And so they're, you know, they go into a pretty basic income state of just paying for a bit of healthcare and picking the fruit off the back trees and taking the grandkids to the beach and that kind of stuff. Well, it hasn't proved to be true. There are a lot of those aged, unemployed, long-term unemployed, who rent. And how exactly are they going to continue to pay these rents that we see in the cities and various other places? And that Australia's going to have to walk up to that one. And it's probably something of a supply side thing, as long as we're a bit short on houses. Nobody's building houses anymore.
Well, again, it's a difficult thing as well, because one, the costs of building has just gone through the roof. And like I saw, and I'd love to get your 2 cents on it, you know, you hear of the government coming in and go, you know, we're going to have this housing fund that's going to build 5 million new homes in the next 10 years or whatever, you know, whatever that policy was. And it's like, cool idea, but we can't build houses as it is because we have no trades, or they're too expensive, and all the construction companies or building companies are all going under because they can't afford. Like, it's great to have the idea, but like, how do you actually put that into place to actually make it happen?
Yeah, the Australian housing market, a bit like the New Zealand one, is pretty weird, but we are facing some real crunches in terms of the number of qualified builders. You can't just, you know, bring people in from overseas and throw them in an Australian building site because of those 4 mega factors, you know, climate. You can't go building substandard houses with no insulation and in an ever increasingly hot and volatile. And, you know, as Queensland's discovered, there's a consequence of global warming called storms and rain as well. That's the flip side of it. You just can't be building substandard houses with mold in them causing massive health problems. And this human ecosystem that revolves around a roof over our heads is really, really complex in that regard. So what we have to do is relatively simple. We need to build smaller houses because Australia has the largest houses in the world now. And we're jamming them on smaller and smaller blocks, which is an environmental impact of its own, creating these massive suburban heat islands. But everyone just, like, this is the challenge now, is we've got those 5 to 7 million old folks living in three-bedroom homes in the suburbs that they're not going to sell. And it's questionable as to whether anybody could afford to buy them anyway. And they're going to live longer, so they're going to hold those houses for 25 years. So the families that might need a three-bedroom home are reliant on building to get it done. I saw a stat. It was American research, but I think it's been validated here as well. For every 50 builders in their 60s who are retiring, you know, so like my builder in New Zealand, an amazing fella, Trevor, super craftsperson, great team organizer, has now finally retired, having built our place. Well, for every for every 50 Trevors going fishing at the lake for the rest of his days, 7 apprentices pass through their first year successfully.
Jesus.
So not only did Trevor have the knowledge and a great teacher of apprentices, and he's out of the system now, those youngsters are facing unbelievably complex engineering standards and red tape to build homes. So the end result, I think, is we get Panasonic and Toyota houses in Australia, and they're smaller. So Panasonic and Toyota make amazing, beautiful prefabricated houses. That's how you buy a house in Japan.
Yeah, right.
They lock together like Lego. They're pre-wired, pre-plumbed, earthquake-proof, heat-proof. They're climate at the highest level compliant. And that's probably where the industry is going to go. And we'll have an industry of assemblers. But we then need the land to put them on, and then the infrastructure supporting those lands. Oh, my goodness. You probably even noticed the increase in traffic in Melbourne coming back over the weekend.
Gave me anxiety just being on the road. It was crazy.
The roads are clogged. And that's with so many people still working from home, mate. But absolutely wild. And it's this understanding that it's all a connected puzzle that's key to kind of working our way out of that puzzle. Because you go, oh, I don't want a prefab home. It doesn't sound like it has the status. Well, if it comes in on time, on budget, and the neighborhood's okay, a prefab home's absolutely fine. We have, I mean, I follow the industry closely, 1,700 bankruptcies in residential home building in the last 2 years. And I don't think the Queensland situation is going to save that. You've seen they've negotiated a remarkable new deal for construction workers with 57 days leave a year, $1,000 a week if you're commuting more than 50 kilometres a day.
Jesus.
5% pay rise till 2027. So, I mean, if you had spare builders in Victoria, they're all kind of live on the Gold Coast now, if they can find a home to live in, that kind of thing. And that there's a lot of arguments about that in the public right now, because, I mean, after the disaster that was the Sydney Shopping Centre, people start to question, do we pay our police enough? Do we pay our nurses enough? And how do you decide those massive societal issues as to who should earn the most money, and where should it go?
Kind of on that idea, as a politician trying to sell the idea of some of these policies that we probably need, but as you said, no one would ever vote for, because hang on, that's going to affect me. Does that kind of come from the, I guess, the ideology of, you know, the great American dream, in that I kind of bring it back to what you were saying with regards to no one should really be owning 5 houses. If a politician stood up there and said that, there'd be a vast majority of the population, but I might one day be able to, like, I'll get myself out of this rut and I'll be able to. So how dare you stop me? And yet I know the statistics, because now I'm in the mortgage broking game, that it's like 1% of the population owns 3 or more properties. And so that idea of we should stop people is going to affect but 1% of the population, and yet the majority of the population go, how dare you tell me I can't own 5 properties, when the likelihood is 99% of the population are never going to own that. So why don't, like, yeah, why don't people want to get on board with that idea when It's well, never it's going to affect
it's a them. Complex puzzle, because a fair proportion of that 1% who own three or more homes work in a big white building in Canberra,
yeah,
in Australia.
Of course.
The median number of properties owned by a parliamentarian, in a federal parliamentarian, it's somewhere between 2 and 3. So they're never going to dismantle trusts, impose taxes, or any of those kind of agendas that do it. But what you're tapping into is what we witnessed when we lived in America in 2000 to 2005, and it's the American dream. And that after a long period of democracy, nearly 250 years in the USA, it just comes down to like shorthand brand values, where you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, and you know what you stand for. And what the mythology, the narrative that's been created around for on the Republican side, is that you might be a dirt poor Nebraska farmer, but you know, with healthcare below the average of the United States, education below the average, life expectancy below the average, and a huge proportion of the population below the poverty line, still one of the most red states, still one of the most Trump-supporting states out there, because they've totally bought the marketing line that chance, the American dream. I don't want communism, I don't want free healthcare and insurance and those guys. That's communism. I'm a capitalist, and the package goes, I love, you know, people have the right to have a gun and free speech, and you know, the abortion is murder, and all of these kind of far out, like that's the Republican package. This is what happens 240 years or 230 years into that democracy. It turns into bread and circuses. Now we risk the same thing, where we're trying to trick a generation into believing now they should support us with our multiple houses and our lack of capital gains taxes and our lower income taxes above, you know. We could pay for all of this if people who earned more than $10 million paid another 20% interest on 20% tax, sorry, income tax. We'd pay for it all. Just not going to happen, because it kind of feels antithetical or anti our dreams and those kind of things. And yeah, your finger's on a big societal problem we have to walk up to. What I do see is a fight back, and it's around that social equity issue in workplaces. So I don't know if your feed's probably not full of this, will be now. It's like a huge scandal in America and a huge sensation. And oh, this millennials and Gen Zs, they're so lazy, Adam, so lazy. And a particularly very influential TikToker took that up and saying, yeah. And she started a handle called Lazy Girl Jobs. And she turned that into a hashtag after kind of starting it out. She now has millions of followers, and she is holding the feet of boomer society and, you know, the Karens who are the bosses at work, really questioning the kind of mythology and narrative around work about why should we be loyal? You know, you're paying me $20 an hour. Why? What is this mythology about working harder and being better off? People are just checking out from that, going, there is no evidence at all that if I devote myself to my job and I get promoted and I do all these things, that I will make the world or my life better. I'm going, that's the seed of a really interesting social movement. You'll now get that filling your social feeds. I get adult TikTok. I get the ones that people have taken the time to put into stories on Instagram and Reels. And I mean, what the heck's going to happen to TikTok, man? Like, they're just about to hand all that traffic to Mark Zuckerberg in the United States.
And can I really wanted to bring that up to you today, because my feed is definitely full of the TikTok ban happening in America and the idea that, you know, you Chinese, you know, run and held company who are stealing all of our data, it's a national security thing, you have to hand it over, else with. Does, because I saw it just went through the House, no problems whatsoever. No doubt the Senate's most likely going to vote it through. And Biden said, if it does get to my desk, I'm signing it. Does TikTok, for lack of a better word, disappear and banned from America? Or does ByteDance say, all right, Meta, you can buy it off us for $750 billion, you know, whatever that number is, kind of thing, and Meta go, ha, thank you very much. And now we, and like, does it just keep rolling on that way? Like, what
they
happens?
Don't even have to buy it, mate. I think it because it just, like, everyone will just migrate. I mean, everyone's got an Instagram account, those TikTok people, because it grows their audience. You know, it is the, you know, the old people audience on Instagram. And yeah, they'll just shut it down and hand all of that money to Mark Zuckerberg, who, like, hold it, 5 minutes ago was in front of the Senate for his lack of responsible behavior toward users and data. The thing with the data is it's already gone. Like, the thing, and what's objectionable about TikTok's handling of that data is, like, you know what, they get everything on your phone. You probably didn't study the terms and conditions closely.
I'll just push back. Like, I'm of the kind of concern, like, I realized many years ago that if I'm on the internet, my privacy's gone. And I've come to terms with that, because yeah, I look at it on the flip side and go, but in a way, it kind of makes my life easier. And I'm actually all for, if you can make a Google Map so precise that when I just open up my phone, it goes, oh, would you like to go home now? Because it knows where my, like, I've subscribed to that and go, you know what? So be it, take it all. I don't really care. So I'm of that opinion. I understand the other side of it though, where people go, hang on, I don't want you tracking how my finger goes and how it goes here, and then you sending me the right, like, I understand people's point of view with that. But
going through your spreadsheets of your deals and reselling your leads to someone else for more money. And it gets very, very tricky. And of course, now artificial intelligence comes into it. I think this is another one of those kind of crossovers between our four mega forces, is the technology and aging gap. It gets very, very interesting. I don't know, with the elders in your family, have you started to go, you know what, don't trust every phone call from me asking for money?
I say to my parents, are probably a unique kind in that they're not a very trusting, that's probably rude to say,
sensible.
But they are very in their own place. So yeah, if they had me calling them going, hey dad, and it, as I said, being a very good deep fake, saying, hey dad, it's Adam here, I need you to transfer me $500,000, like, dad would be like, I don't care if you are in trouble. That's your own problem. Go away. Like, one, he probably would say that, but for two, he wouldn't trust that in the first place anyway. So,
okay. So he is probably more savvy than many. This is the interesting thing. Cause I mean, that's the nature of elderly people, is they're waiting their time out. They've got often six figures, 100,000, 200,000 in a bank account. They're drawing down very carefully. That and the social engineering capable through the level of video deepfake now is pretty mind-blowing. And this is the drama of AI, is they're gathering such a picture of you that they're able to socially engineer others. And we've all seen them, you know, whether it's the simplest thing, you like in Melbourne, it's Linked, the people who do the tolls going, oh, hey, a text from Linked, your car wasn't picked up. And there's going to be coincidentally a moment that you have just passed through one of those on the way. And so, so believable, so, so clever. And that's a really dark side to this whole generative AI world that's being so heavily invested in. This is the crypto kids' new kind of fascination. And trying for governments to legislate to control that, whether it's through ByteDance or whether it's, you know, OpenAI and Microsoft and Amazon and Google and the other big players who have, I saw the number today, $25 billion US dollars was sunk into generative AI in 2023. That is an enormous amount of money to go chasing a technology. And of course, NVIDIA, who make the lowest level component of the chain, the cards that are able to process huge amounts of data, is the winner. But wow, that's phenomenal. And going back to that point about, you know, workplaces and productivity per hour worked, everyone I know in our research at ThoughtWorks, which is my day job, is chasing productivity gains from AI. They're going, you know what, if I could just not have to do that bit, the paperwork or the phoning people or whatever, I could actually get on with this. Back to your case study of, could I lay half the staff off and make the same amount of money? The dimension of that story that's going to play out in the next 10 years is the half my staff who've now retired and don't want to work for me, how do I get the job done with the half that remain? And you better have some kind of AI to take the drudge and toil out of so many jobs accordingly. But the challenge becomes not the technology. The technology is going to advance as rapidly as anything you've ever seen. The challenge is the culture that Australian organisations have built with its younger generation employees. So here's the counterpoint to AI lending a huge amount of productivity per hour worked, if we go to the OECD's kind of critical measure, is what's happening or potentially happening is a person using an AI tool to write the script for this webinar, for example. So if we were planning to do this and we had, oh, let's just brainstorm some ideas and topics we want to get through, you tell your ChatGPT, generate me the kind of dot points that are cool and what's hip and hot right now. Then we probably call a meeting with both of our extensive marketing and support teams that we have. And we'd waste five people's time looking through the six options that ChatGPT gave both of us for the kind of dot points for this conversation. So we actually have spent more hours getting that done than if we'd just taken the call and just gone, what are you interested in? What's hot? What are you interested in? And got it done. And equally, a generation who feel pretty hard done by, the lazy girl job generation, or girl work boss, as she rebranded to, they're just going to have a cup of coffee, mate. They're going to finish that job in half the time and go and have an almond latte.
It's an interesting point you bring out, because I do have a couple of those, in quote, TikTokers on my page. There's a girl I love. She's just got the name Laura. And she has this toodaloo, and her cup always says that the cup handle is a C and then it's UNT on it. So toodaloo. And she talks about many of those things where, as I said, this idea that, I mean, I certainly felt it very much from my parents. I think they were of that generation. It's like, you know, you go through university, you get the stable job, you work there, you do your part. 40 years later, down the line, you bought your white picket fence, you've had your family, you've had the nuclear experience, and then you retire. That's what you do. And you will be rewarded for that loyalty of the 40 years there, because you'll just work yourself up the chain. You don't really lose your job because everyone stays in their job for 40 years. I feel that now having had a family myself and going through that, like I'm lucky not to have to be in the corporate world. And so I don't have to be beholden to a boss or a conglomeration where I'm just part of the kind of jigsaw puzzle. But I can feel that sense that, like, hang on, companies are a very different thing these days, and they're just asking more and more and more of their employees and not giving anything more for that more, with no guarantee that you will be promoted or that you will be here next week, because, you know, if things change, your job's done, get out. That worker thing, I see their point of view is like, why would I give my life and my soul and my energy to give you everything I possibly can when there's no guarantee of tomorrow or no guarantee of promotion?
I think they've called it. They're calling the bullshit on our narrative, which is the post-war narrative. And as less and less champions of that narrative, you know, work hard, get ahead. Well, there's a ton of people, you know, Noah's age, 22, who are going, you know what, I don't think I'm going to get on the property ladder at this rate. A, you bastards own them all, and you're making it very unliquid or illiquid, because you're not releasing your homes, which are trading for other homes and other homes. And this is why houses are held for so long in Australia now. But yeah, they're calling it, man. Like, I recommend anyone wants to follow it. Anti-Work Girl Boss is her account. 400,000 followers. And she happily takes the highlights onto Instagram Reels for people like me. But it's a cogent argument, you know? And it's not just a straight argument that you should get a side hustle. It's that, you know, you do the job. You turn up and do the job, but you don't answer the phone on the weekends. And of course, we've now got legislation that prevents the after-work contact element as well. So that's a really interesting Australian take on all of that. How did that emerge, to have to legislate to prevent harassment by boomers and X of a younger generation. And I'm told it was largely to do with healthcare workers getting harassed after hours. But I know, I mean, that's going to play into the most astonishingly entertaining lawsuits for employers who are caught. I mean, the technology is going to track it, isn't it? I'm going to see the text message record, open and shut case. You broke the law.
And I mean, my mind goes to a place of like, how does, I kind of think outside of that, just, I mean, I think it's completely fine. I mean, as I said, if your job is 9 to 5, you are paying me to be here 9 to 5. And that kind of rhetoric that comes from the other side, though, of that, you know, work hard, you know, you're not putting in enough work. That's why you're not getting
a promotion.
Ahead.
Work hard. She's working hard.
But I think it's slowly becoming okay to like, no, but I'm happy with how this is. Like, and that kind of future for that version of that person is becoming a more popular idea, because I think it's easy to sell the dream if you can see all of these people working harder and doing better. But if you see all of these people working harder and they're not doing better via their work hard metrics, then it's hard to sell that dream. And yet you have the flip side to it that, you know, these girl boss things and the other ones I just spoke about as well, saying, no, you don't have to aspire to have 10 homes or, you know, all of these kind of metrics that, you know, you're only successful if you've done that. I mean, I really hope it is, because I mean, it's certainly a message I tell to my girls, and it's a message I live as well through my life, in that if you were to go and ask my girls now, what does daddy do for a job? Both of them would probably say, oh, he looks at his phone and he sits on his computer. Like, they, because I'm so much involved in their life that work really isn't the most important part of my life anymore. Look, I've done the 15 years of building a business and like, I worked those 100-hour weeks for 10 years straight kind of thing to get to a place where I can take this kind of time with my girls. But if I had my time again and I had a family at a younger age, I'd like to think that I would still be in a place now where I can be as involved with my girls as it is, because it's a cliche thing, is that you'll never regret spending more time with your family kind of thing.
Where that argument's absolutely front and center right now is hashtag RTO, return to office. So another sort of social equity workplace war is, should people who've had this 4 years COVID remote work have their arm twisted that to come back in the office? And oh my goodness, the jury is out on this one. There's data for both sides, but it's a generational war of people who really were very uncomfortable working from home, older groups who, you know, a lot of their job was supervision and all those kind of things, very difficult to do on Zoom.
Yeah.
And worried about their value and their, you know, their validity as an employee, and thinking about, oh my goodness, what am I going to get replaced by, a kind of a little Zoom app widget thing, or what's going to happen? A part of a younger generation who live in terrible homes and actually want to get back to the office because, you know, it's cold in the winter and they live in north of, you know, one of those North Melbourne dives that so many people, substandard housing, are forced to live in. And then half of them are going, no, I'm pretty happy working from a co-work nearby or the cafe or whatever. I get my job done. I don't want to come back to the office and be supervised by Nigel, you know, who's just counting the minutes I'm spending in the bathroom every day. And this messy. It's the messy middle. It's the liminal time in between the before and the after that we are living in today. Nobody wants to be in the middle. We want it either finished. You want that plane flight. That's a perfect example of what liminal space and time feels like, is sitting on the plane from Melbourne to Perth. It's like, oh my goodness, I wish we'd never left the lounge.
Yeah.
You know, that was quite comfortable. I was enjoying it there. And another, you know, Amelia might be going, I just wish we should get there and get home and I can watch TV or whatever. And well, that's us. We're stuck on the plane of change in this time in the 2020s, and it's probably not going to land for another couple of years before things start to really fall into place. And I don't know. I don't, you know, when we're dead, I'm not sure what Noah will do with the wealth he will inherit. I'm not sure there'll even be any, because It could be if we don't solve this population problem, nobody wants to buy our houses. You can buy a, you know, a house in Italy for €1.
I saw that advert come up.
And they're legit. There's so much town tax, city tax owed on those places, they've been repossessed. So there's now a serious number of American cities with the same problem, where the city is being, you know, repossessing homes that owe huge amounts of taxes on them, and they're selling them for $1. And is that actually going to be what happens here for us? I was looking at one this morning. Where is this town? Cairo, Illinois, is America's newest ghost town. Having peaked at 15,000 population 100 years ago, has fallen to just 1,700 in 2020. And, you know, they're looking at that, okay, well, the city should maybe sell these houses for $1. And, you know, maybe in the world of technology, you can work remotely and live in these places for nothing. But yeah, just because you've got this gigantic pile of property wealth today doesn't necessarily guarantee it's worth the same in 20 years. And we may have sold down and used that money to pay for our aged health and all those kind of things. And yeah, this is a super trend I notice, is a group of people, you know, clapping back, as the young people say, on the whole mythology of work hard and have a satisfying life and pay your taxes. It's like, you know what? My favorite is an Indian guy, Masood Boomgard. Have you caught up with him on social media? He's so funny. He's just got this full-on guru voice. He's just going, I won't on, you know, but to hell with your Teams meeting. Your Teams meeting could have been an email. And he's just brilliant. Like, and it really expresses the culture of these times among that generation. So the answer is we don't really know what's going to happen, but I think it's worth plugging in for the ride. And I think people's values will be tested, people's beliefs of what's important. And I think it will come back to the family. If you're lucky, maybe the street that you live on as a community will reemerge. And yeah, we don't elect too many Donald Trumps.
On that point, before I do let you go, because I know your time's precious and I appreciate every second that you do give to me, I want to get on to Mr. Trump, because it used to be one of our hot topics that we used to talk about every Friday, because for obviously a four-year period during our time as client and coach, he was the president of the United States, and you always had something to, you know, I'd come in and, all right, Nigel, what's he done this week? Let's discuss. Yeah, and so
he's unstoppable.
And so as a guy who's obviously going through criminal proceedings now, and whether he's found guilty or not, obviously that time will tell. But there's still a very high number and percentage of the American population who have, whether you want to say bought in or accept or ride or die, whatever it is, they will be voting for him at the next election. And the flip side is an aging man who loses his mind every second day. And as you said, to your point, it's like, well, I don't really kind of believe a lot of what Trump's saying, but God, the alternative is not that great either. So maybe, like, so they can be persuaded there. Just the question I'm kind of getting to, one, does he win in November? And two, what does the world look like for the next 4 years with a Mr. Trump at the head, if that's the case, kind of going forward?
Well, look, I've got a very expensive bottle of wine on the line with some friends back in New Zealand over the fact he will just walk in.
What kind of numbers are you saying?
Through corrupt methods or not. Like, it's a done deal. The only thing that'll possibly upset that is the votes of women in the United States. And I think he's really sorely underestimated how much his sponsorship of women's rights, or anti-women's rights, the abortion laws, how much that's actually annoyed women of both sides, but particularly Republicans, all the way to the top, all the way to the top of the age categories. You know, there'll be a lot of boomer women do not vote for Trump. And they'll do it quietly, you know, like it'll be the quiet quitting. It'll be the quiet not voting. That's the only thing that'll take it close, because the American political system is so janky, man. Like, it just doesn't work like straight out votes. New Zealand proportional representation or first past the post here don't work that way, man. There's an electoral college and it's completely biased to the red states. So you only have to win a few to win the lot. And even if he doesn't get in, I think there'll be so much civil unrest over the legitimacy of the election that they'll, you know, have to declare some kind of martial law and lock him up. But it doesn't matter if he's in prison or not. It doesn't matter if somebody shoots him, because the martyrdom that results will enable whoever follows in his shoes to take a similar position. This is just the last, this is the bread and circuses era of America's democracy. We've done it. You know, that the bicentennial was in the 70s, the whatever, sesquicentennial, 150. Don't ask me how I know that. that's coming up, and that's the end of it. That's, you know what? They had their arc of society, civil war results. And so civil war is an interesting social phenomenon.
Have you seen the movie that's out now?
It's happened in my lifetime. It's happened in my lifetime. There's a couple of, like, the textbook definition, if we pull it down, it's quite simple. So it's a country with two very divided populations and a government struggling to decide and get forced into making a call of deploying either an element of the police or the military for one of the two sides. It's made especially easy if the citizenry have access to weaponry. Well, it's pretty much what we're facing. In my lifetime, it happened in Northern Ireland. So you're too young to remember the Catholic and Protestant separatism, like bombings, like the war was on. And the British government laid in on the side of the Protestants, and, you know, the army was in Northern Ireland. And Britain was in uproar in 1974. And then it was a form of civil war, because there were, you know, you've been to London since. Why is there no rubbish bins on the streets? Because the bombings were weekly.
Yeah.
Now we're, you know, at the other end, we're 50 years on from that time. So we're kind of forgetting it. And yeah, mate, if you go into America at any time, go before Christmas, because I don't know you'll get in after that. You've got to read Margaret Atwood stories to start to understand how low that world can go. Promising the largest deportation of aliens in human history. And I mean, they have no difficulty at all. You see there's a deliberate geography split going on, with states starting to assert more authority than others. I mean, that's the original American Civil War, which is, you know, a couple of centuries ago now, started very simply. You know, seven states just walked away going, nah, we're done. We want to keep our slaves. And effectively, we're battling over economic slavery now. And, you know, there's people working for next to no wages at all who are basically economic slaves, domestic slaves or otherwise. And there's a whole proportion of American society think that's pretty fine, actually. And if God wanted them to be rich, they'd have been rich. And they've just, the narrative, the control of the narrative, the whole, I mean, Trump's inspiration from the World Wrestling Federation. I don't know if you, again, you would have been a kid when Trump was a big part of WWE, but that's where he learned his entire style from, is the theater of wrestling.
Interesting.
And he's a genius. Like, the people shout back his, it's like a Rocky Horror Picture Show where you go and the audience have got audience participation going on. All he has to do is say coded words and the audience buoy him through. But I have to say, he's not looking well in the New York court at the moment. What's your health diagnosis as a health professional?
Well, he's a very overweight man who doesn't do a lot of, or if any, exercise whatsoever, and eats, supposedly, obviously this is all secondhand information, but supposedly eats nothing but junk food all day. And he's very proud of that fact. And he, you know, it's not uncommon to know the knowledge around kind of a lot of the deaths that happened during COVID were from people who had type 2 diabetes, underlying heart conditions, or the overweight, he kind of almost became this godlike figure because he got COVID and he's an overweight type 2 diabetic, unhealthy guy. And he, a couple of days, kicked it. And he's like, look at me kind of thing. So I kind of just say that purely just from the fact that, yes, he's not looking great and he's overweight, but he still seems to stride forward with great energy in what he does if you compare it to the opposite guy, who is this a fitter looking lean guy, and yet he looks like he's on death's door, like kind of thing. So
yeah, they're both pretty elderly to be doing that level of activity, but you know, it's a shame because America's shifting. I mean, the Middle East, what a crisis ridden disaster zone that is right now. But that, I'll be honest, over a 200 year history, it's business as usual. Like Middle Eastern wars again between the factions have been a factor of our lives for two centuries, and we probably didn't help them in the West by creating part of it. European conflict, Ukraine, business as usual, man. That shit's been going down with Russia and various other people. The whole refugee crisis, the move to conservatism. We've seen all this before a dozen times over. China, you know, the rise of China, you know, they have their setbacks occasionally, but that's definitely been a very long term. That's a 100-year trend we're seeing as they got their act together and had some turmoil. And then, you know, now they're the new capitalism, basically century planned capitalism. America's the one that's sliding down the hill in terms of their 250 years. And it's not pleasant to watch, to be fair. And I think it will lead to a mass exodus of wealthy Americans to Hawke's Bay in New Zealand, where I'm from, and Perth, both beautiful places to live. And maybe that'll be what saves Australia along the way. But yeah, it's really sad to see America. I was very keen on the American opportunity 25 years ago when I was a young fella. And now it's just like, don't even bother. I think the last time I saw you was when we were getting Noah's citizenship renounced in Perth at the embassy, and like that's a big move to walk away, but we're very serious about that, that's for sure. But yeah, look, you control what you can control, and the truth is, for us, this is what I've always enjoyed about our conversations, is that we talked about, you know, health as your investment for life. It's like a health superannuation account, I think is the best way of doing it. We're all keyed up on buying investment properties and getting money in our super and all those kind of things. We need desperately a generation of people in their 30s today to get healthier, because Australia cannot financially support them when they're 70.
Mm.
And I think that's going to lead to a massive kind of kick in an investment in that side of our society. And I reckon some norms are going to change massively, and hopefully you're at the front end of that, mate. But it's just the simple things of exercise and diet, and that's the investment Australia needs to make to not go bankrupt in 2050.
My only flip to that, and it goes back to something we said very fairly early on in today, is that I think more and more people today, because I think fitness has had its trend time. Like I was very lucky that I can certainly remember during the 80s when I was a very young fella kind of coming up, remember seeing professional, what was it called? Professional aerobics on the screen on Wide World of Sports. And I can remember that vividly, sitting down every Saturday after I'd finished playing competitive tennis. Lunchtime was had at home. We would sit in front, watch Wide World of Sports for 2 hours on TV. And there would be a 10-minute segment of professional aerobics, and they'd be dancing and jumping and push-upping and things like that. And that was, I believe, the kind of start of the fitness revolution, where then fitness had a good 30-plus year run of people understanding, oh, fitness is an important part of my life, and I can see that it's not just for the professional athletes, that everyday Joe and Jody should go out and probably do some sort of exercise. And it was pushed by this rise of watching people actively become active kind of thing. Mm. But I see it, and as I said, comes back to what we're saying before, is that that has been drummed so much that more and more people are just like, I've heard it. Yes, I know I should exercise more. But I believe something is coming along to save me. I'm going to be able to have the pill at some point. Yeah. At some point, I'm going to be able to take a pill and it's going to get rid of all my worries. And so they're just riding on this technology will save me.
Yeah.
I know I should exercise, but so that's where I'm kind of starting to see some pushback now in that it's harder to drum up business because I'm in the business of fitness. It's harder to drum up business of, hey guys, I've got this new program. You should come and join. Whereas 10 years ago, I did that. I had 200 people knocking on my door going, yep, I want to be part of that program. Now it's harder and harder to get people to go, look, your $400 program for the next 6 weeks. It sounds great, Adam. Like, I love what you're doing here, but look, $400, like, I've got an energy bill to pay for. I've got groceries to like, and I get it.
And that's true. You know,
and it is true. And I absolutely understand it. I'll wait until the next program. Just let me know when the next one comes out. And inevitably, I run the next one and it's like, whatever. And I think in the back of the mind, there is that little seed of maybe there's something just around the corner that they're going to release. And it's this wonder drug or therapy or AI that can help me achieve the goals that will only cost me $4, not the $400. And so that's my only concern with what you're saying.
It's a fascinating insight. And, you know, if you were to take that kind of very long-term view of that bread and circuses end of an arc of society, the very, very strong need to create a nation of watchers. So getting your proletariat, your poor people all into the stadiums and making them super fans and the cult of fandom is very much a part of that decline because people, you know, they don't perceive themselves as a sports person. They perceive themselves as a sports fan. They love sports. Don't do it.
Mm.
So if you and I were deliberately trying to take over the nation, we would definitely set out and completely reinforce people spending that $400 on some West Coast Eagles, you know, loyalty outfits and hats and stuff, and not on a program that helped their own health. And there's a lot of people making a lot of money out of that. You know, you combine that with in America's case, where people are, you know, tribally loyal to so many different sports franchises, and you add to it the kind of decline in education standards over there, you go, man, this is a sci-fi novel of how to control a society. It's just generation after generation, tolerate them dropping out of school, lowering your education standards, giving them terrible diets, and making them couch potatoes as super fans. Gee, we probably could take the world over if we did that, Adam.
Well, Nigel, I appreciate those insights and those chats. And I guess before people leave this podcast, yeah, I always like trying to paint a positive picture on things in that the next, we'll call it short term. I don't want to go the next 100 years. What does it look like? But like the next 5 to 10 years for average Joe and Jody sitting at home right now going, okay, cool. You painted a pretty dark picture here with some little highlights here and there. But for me, Nigel, Joe and Jody sitting right here, how does my life look like for the 99% of the population who aren't the Zuckerbergs and Bezoses who have the billions, who it's never going to affect them anyway? How does 99% of the population's life play out for the next 5, 10 years? What are they looking positive? What do they need to do to make sure that they are kind of still part of this worldly experiment that we sit in every day and don't kind of fall by the wayside? And you've kind of said, aren't just one paycheck away from living in their car kind of thing on the side of the road and wondering, how did this all happen?
It is. I think it's a matter of leaning forward and not leaning back in the next 10 years. It's not leaving it to other people to send a note to that politician or otherwise. I mean, it's pretty tough. We have a crossroads in Australia of the period before bread and circuses is kind of an entrustment of science and technology and innovation, and you go, well, why doesn't Australia have the world's leading industry around solar power? I mean, we goddamn invented it, which Australian the solar panel, Australian invention, and low water agriculture, and all of these amazing sustainable technologies that the world's going to need, and Musk's going to need because he's going to need that stuff on Mars, so he might buy it off us. But people have to lean in, you know, like, and they do have to look after their families because you're going to a world where Like the state's just not going to have the money to do it. And it does come down to the absolutely fundamental of look after your health. Because, I mean, I've seen it, how much money I spend on the slightest dramas that occur in my health life with a heart valve and all those kind of things. And I have to be so careful about gum disease and these little complications they never told me about when I was 30 that I should have done, you know, I should have flossed better at 30 to not be paying $1,000 a year for special dental care for gum disease at 60. And I think those are the controllable things. Those are the within your sphere of control. You know, encourage your kids to get educated, encourage them to know about stuff and do stuff. And, you know, it's not all forms of education are free anymore, but all you can do is lean in and just know that it's better off now than 100 years ago. As much as I would dearly love to be incredibly optimistic, but always amidst chaos is opportunity. You could be Trump and seeing create chaos and cause his own opportunity amidst the chaos that's coming to us around climate and aging and social equity and new techs. There's opportunities to help people. And, you know, that's, I'm always reminded. So Viktor Frankl, who wrote a book, an incredible book after World War II, and was, the book's all about what does it mean? What's life? The meaning of life. And he was a psychologist. And he's actually a psychiatrist who was interned in a Nazi death camp in World War II. So that's about as low as it goes, right? He was kept alive because of his ability being a GP before he was trained as a psychologist and became a psychiatrist. So he helped keep prisoners alive. And he, after all of that terrible time, returning back, he survived. It was an absolutely unbelievable story. And what he was asked, well, it was like, you've been so low. What's the meaning of life anyway? Like, why do it? And his wisdom's brilliant. And he said, the meaning of life is to help others find the meaning of their lives. And when we all do that, then and lean into that, we kind of feed each other and carry each other through. And none of us get out of it alive. But if we're all engaged in that, and whether it's this kind of conversation or whether it's your kids, that's the secret.
Well, I can't think of a better way to finish that off. I think that's a beautiful sentiment and a beautiful quote. And yeah, I mean, if I can sum it up, lean in, spend more time and kind of due diligence around your family and kind of supporting them and then supporting others in their quest to support their family and things like that. And we should all do better off by it and then just watch the circus from the sides and get your popcorn out to enjoy the ride.
Yeah, be grateful we live down under, mate. It's fantastic.
Absolutely. Well, mate, as always, I appreciate your time and your insights and chats. I miss these dearly on my Friday mornings, but I'm appreciative of the fact that we can have them from time to time because Very of the good. Wonderful world of technology and Zoom that we can sit here across the nation.
Precisely. Precisely. All right. Well, enjoy your long weekend. I hope you're taking Friday and we'll see you sometime in the future.
We certainly will, mate. Guys, appreciate your time. Cheers. I don't know when the next episode's going to be back because these are one off these days, but I love you for being here anyway. Hope you all enjoyed the conversation and I'll talk to you whenever we talk to you. Ciao.